Are you prepared for a deep dive into the world of neuromorphic computing? I certainly hope so. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, this here electronic engineering podcast brought to you by EEJournal.com, which is written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. Yes, we are talking about the past, present, and future of neuromorphic computing today. My guest is Mike Davies from Intel, and we're talking about the intersection between neuromorphic computing and artificial intelligence, the details of Intel's unique, now open source, Lava software development platform, and the details of Intel's Lohihi 2 neuromorphic chip. The future is neuromorphic, but how do we get there? That is exactly our project today. Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Amelia. It's great to be here. Tell you about our exciting announcements this week.
Excellent. Okay, so we're talking about neuromorphic computing today, but for my audience who may not know, what exactly is neuromorphic computing?
So neuromorphic computing is about rethinking what computation really means from the perspective of biology and looking deep inside brains of organisms in nature to see how has evolution developed solutions for the kinds of computational problems we're interested in, yet are dramatically different in what we've arrived at through conventional computing. So it's studying neuroscience and related brain science fields to discover insights about the principles of information processing and computation in circuits that might be applicable to chips that we're able to design and build today.
Okay, now this seems to be advancing AI a lot as we know it today. So can you help me understand what exactly is the difference between today's AI approaches and neuromorphic? And why do we even need this different approach?
Today's AI, which most people have deep learning in mind when we say that, that's what's the approach that's delivered such amazing progress over the last decade or so. It's operating on a very simplified model of neural computation. So, of course, there is biological inspiration behind deep networks and today's, you know, greatest AI technologies. If you go back quite a few decades and you look at what is the neural network model that we're computing with these deep learning models, it is an approximation in a very, very crude way of what neurons in the brain are computing. And look at where it's taken us today. It's incredible capabilities that seem to scale in an almost limitless way as you provide these models with more computational power and more data. But that's also its limitation. And that's the challenge that we face in deploying these AI advances into the real world and putting this kind of intelligent functionality into form factors that may be power limited in sometimes severe ways, or latency limited, or data limited. Once we're into that regime, think about drones that would fly and navigate through the world with great agility and respond to new environments and change in the environment in the way that, say, a bird does, a cockatiel bird, you know, very simple bird, for example, that has incredible adaptation and learning capabilities. When we compare these two types of technologies, we see still that there's a dramatic difference between what brains and the types of neural networks that are literally implemented in biological brains, the types of flexibility, power efficiency, and latency that these types of systems are able to achieve compared to the best technology can provide today using today's AI and computational tools. In the neuromorphic computing domain, it's not about solving the same exact problems that are focused on in the conventional AI world, just solving these, you know, in a somewhat more energy efficient way. It's about deploying new categories of computation that is fundamentally faster and more adaptable and more power efficient than the approaches that we're pursuing, you know, in conventional AI.
That makes sense. Now, Mike, where do you see or already are seeing applications for this kind of technology? And why is neuromorphic particularly well suited for these applications versus conventional computing technologies?
So we're seeing applications across a pretty surprising range, actually. And that's maybe not that surprising. It's really when you consider the breadth of capabilities and workloads that brains in nature support, we are basically finding applications of our neuromorphic chips in all of those areas. And sometimes they're somewhat abstracted forms of that. So maybe I'll start with some of the more obvious ones, and that would be sensing. So obviously we can train a deep neural network to process audio, to process input from a variety of sensors and vision sensors and perform some pretty impressive types of intelligent computation and intelligent processing. But what we're finding with neuromorphic computing is that we can perform some of these same types of inferences just with much lower latency and much lower power. So think about, for example, sensing the touch, the tactile sensing of a new emerging electronic skins that people are researching and putting on the actuators, the arms and hands of robotic systems, so that we can make them more agile and more effective at manipulating soft objects, fragile objects, ultimately being able to put these types of robotic systems into the home or into environments where they have to coexist and operate safely with humans. We need a sensing technology there that is able to process this kind of input at very low latencies. If you're thinking about sense of touch, within milliseconds of touching something, it has to really have an understanding of, is this a compliant soft object or is it a brittle hard object? Is it moving as it touches it or is it properly grasping it? Is it slipping or holding it steady, for example? And this is an example where some of our collaborators have found that this event-based kind of spiking model of AI or inference neural networks can provide great gains in both the latency and the power efficiency. Traditionally, with conventional computing, you can make great strides in one or the other. You can speed up a computation by throwing lots of power and running the transistors faster, or you can make a computation more energy efficient by slowing things down. And so one or the other can be optimized, but not both together without something more fundamentally changing. So neuromorphic solutions in these domains are providing gains in both of these dimensions, which allows us to put, in this case, sensing technology for audio, for touch, for video, into a form factor which is constrained in all of these dimensions. But on the other hand, we're finding applications in areas you might not even associate with neural networks. So things like solving optimization problems. So if you know, you think back to school and some of the basic computer science algorithms that people develop and apply to solve hard problems, constraint satisfaction problem, integer linear programming, quadratic programming, these are mathematical formulations of optimization problems that are NP-complete, NP-hard is the terminology here, you know, very difficult problems that grow exponentially fast in their execution time to solve harder problems. And optimization at the root of it is something that brains are performing and computing at all times. No matter what decision you're making, if you're navigating an environment, you're moving, you know, your limbs, you're planning your day or how to tackle a problem, all of these involves factoring in the constraints that you as an organism faces and finding the best possible solution or the best way forward. And optimization is a class of problem that we're finding Loihi and now Loihi 2, our next chip, are solving incredibly well. So we can outperform the best CPU-based solvers by orders of magnitude, primarily in energy efficiency. So well over 1,000 times greater energy efficiency for solving some of these hard computational problems, but also in solution time. So somewhere between 10 to 100 times speedups for solving these types of optimization problems compared to conventional approaches. So you put this all together and you find a surprising breadth of applications that neuromorphic computing can, in the future, solve and put future kind of great advances in computational power and intelligence into form factors that otherwise simply couldn't either process with the speed that's required, you know, or the energy required, you know, or both.
Okay, so Mike, I saw there was some news recently about Lava, a software framework that you've released to open source. So tell me more about this announcement and where should my audience go for more information about this?
So Lava is our attempt to address a problem that we're seeing in the field, which is really holding back progress. And that's lack of convergence at the algorithmic software application levels. So with Loihi, the previous generation of chip that we released a little over 3 years ago now, we were focusing mostly at the silicon chip level and just the lowest level of software support to make the chip usable by our research partners. And it was sufficient to do a lot of evaluations of different workloads and different algorithmic approaches, and to bring some rigor into the benchmarking. So quantifying what gains, you know, which approaches gain the best results, which gave the least. But we weren't trying to provide abstractions, programming abstractions to users that go beyond this kind of basic register level programming model. And effectively, we're hoping that someone else in the field would come along and provide the progress and the compelling software advances that would bring the field together and sort of elevate the level of programming from one that requires basically a PhD in computational neuroscience to really understand, to a level that general developers would be able to come into the field and rapidly deploy the work of others and into applications that had, you know, not been previously dreamed of. But that hasn't happened. So after these 3 years, we're still programming at this, you know, excruciatingly low level of individual registers, of specifying specific network parameters and network connectivity. There are some utilities and there's tools and there's point solutions that have been quite productive and helped, but we're just not seeing a lot of sharing of results and code between the different groups that would allow teams of researchers to build on top of, to the point of ultimately providing those software libraries and frameworks that grows the community to the non-expert, non-specialist domain. So Lava is our attempt to address that need. So we don't have all the answers in terms of software programming abstractions and tools and methods yet. It's not a finished product. It's really the beginning of a journey. We're releasing an improved version of our original software framework in a fully open sourced way. We've licensed this with permissive licensing, so a combination of BSD for most of it, as well as LGPL for some of the lower level parts of it. And that's specifically to encourage people to converge, to use this software framework, to extend it, to port it to their own platforms, and simply create a more vibrant community of developers where progress can be shared and built on and advanced across these different teams. Ultimately, that's going to be what's required to develop applications and a whole ecosystem of developers that can deploy this technology commercially.
That makes sense. Now, Mike, who can access Lo-hihi 2 today and how?
So access to Lo-hihi 2, the hardware itself, is still controlled through our Intel Neuromorphic Research Community framework. So this is a organization that requires a legal agreement to be signed with Intel. And that's basically the requirements of developing research silicon in a company such as Intel, that we're not at this point able to just deploy these to the general public without some kind of an evaluation agreement being executed. So those members of that community, which now numbers almost 150 groups around the world, from the leading universities to industry groups, as well as government research labs, all of those people will have access to Lo-hihi. They can access it through our cloud systems for now. So they'll remotely log in and they can start kicking the tires and evaluating some of the new features and characterize the new performance. But it will be some time until we can make these systems available generally to anybody without going through that engagement process. So it's still a research community for now. Of course, in the long term, we hope to provide commercial access to these chips, but that may still be some years off.
Mike, let's talk about your role as a researcher in particular here. So what has stumped you the most as you've gone down this journey to understand the human brain for inspiration for this next generation of AI? What has been surprising and where do you think the biggest challenges remain?
I think the biggest surprise is that we so quickly reached the limits of the analytical scientific tools available to us to really make sense and model the kinds of computation that we find in the brain. That's not to say that we can't make progress and that we can definitely understand certain subsystems and certain aspects and principles of the way the brain works. But it's been very surprising just how limited our, say, mathematics and our conventional computer science abstractions and understandings are for developing a comprehensive framework and theory for neural computation in the biological sense that we see in brains. So I guess that's been the real humbling part of it. You know, it's not a matter of just going back to the textbooks from, you know, grad school and dusting them off and coming up with the right approaches and the right models. It's really a matter of engaging deeply with the greatest minds that are in any of these related fields, whether it's neuroscience or engineering or even mathematics at the most fundamental level. So that's been the biggest challenge. It's not exactly clear what the way forward is to produce a fully comprehensive framework. But at the same time, that's why it's really exciting fundamental research. And the strategy we've been taking is to chip off pieces that are well understood and well characterized. So things from the sensing domain, for example, looking at the way the circuits in our olfactory bulb in the brain recognize odors and learn new odors. These are manageable problems that we can study and produce technology from that, understand the way that biological neurons are operating in a real fundamental way, and ultimately with the long-term goal of coming up with something comprehensive that can span the scope of an entire brain. But I think we're still years away from that. And anyone who looks deeply at some of these fundamental challenges that are coming from brain research, you know, has to be a little humbled by the outlook for AI in general and, you know, bringing fundamental intelligence into our future devices. We're still a long way away. It's going to be an exciting journey and we're, you know, making a lot of progress, but this is a very, very difficult challenge that we face collectively.
Absolutely. Now, Mike, let's talk about you a little bit. You were at Caltech, I understand, and then at a company called Fulcrum before you joined Intel. So how did you even stumble upon this very cool emerging field?
Well, it maybe wasn't as coincidental as it might sound. Actually, the modern field of neuromorphic computing, neuromorphic engineering, actually started at Caltech. And that was right in the time frame when I was there. I was kind of at the very tail end of when Carver Mead was building the first analog VLSI chips that would process vision input in the way that the retina does, or trying to replicate that, basically. And he coined the term neuromorphic. And so that definitely got me excited way back in my school days. And this was in the 90s. And I took some neuroscience classes and really found the whole area very, very exciting. But I went off on a different trajectory from that point. I joined up with some Caltech students that were starting this company, Fulcrum, to apply asynchronous design techniques to general chips of all sorts at that time, and as a new way to design chips without clocks. And anybody in the electrical engineering knows that, you know, synchronous design is very, very deeply embedded in the field and as the predominant way to design any kind of a circuit. And so with asynchronous circuits, we were completely turning that on its head and finding out how to design chips that don't have this global clock in them. And we spent 11 years building Ethernet chips that were leading the industry in many respects, the latency and the integration levels that we achieved in those switch chips. Intel acquired us, and after another generation of switch development, I started looking for new places where we could take this asynchronous design technology that we had developed and kind of honed over the years as a methodology, as an approach. And found at that point, it was pretty good timing that there was an increasing interest in neuromorphic research in the industry. There was a big DARPA program, a couple other companies exploring this area. And the opportunity was there to apply this tool, this asynchronous design tool, to this type of new emerging computing technology that really, really needs it. More than anything else, the brain is an asynchronous computer, computing information with spikes where the timing of those spikes is encoding information, and there is no global clock. So we happen to have the right tool for the job right at the time when this interest in neuromorphic computing was revving up. So that's how I got into it. And from that point on, we've just been scrambling with a growing team and expanding beyond the scope of the circuits and the asynchronous design to the algorithmic, the architecture, the software development that, you know, we need to deliver the entire package of technology.
I love it. That's a great story, Mike. Now, it is time for your off-the-cuff question. So since you haven't been on my show before, I'm throwing this at all my new guests. So, Mike, a lot of us can't have our favorite foods now because we're on one level of lockdown or another. So if you could have one meal right now, it doesn't matter if you need a passport to get there. It's on the other side of your state or the restaurant is closed. What would you have?
Well, I might say borscht. for a totally random answer. So this is a Russian dish, and I recently got married to a Russian, and we were recently in Russia, sneaking under these lockdown restrictions and to meet her family. And I was introduced to some great Russian food. And now I'm back in the States, but that memory is still in my head.
I love it. Borscht is an amazing soup. It sounds absolutely delicious right now. Well, Mike, I think that's all I have time for. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thanks and before we go, don't forget to check out my new maker-themed monthly fish fry podcast series called Makers Today. In our fourth episode of this series, I chat with Kitty Young from Art by Physicist. Kitty and I chat about the variety of super cool designs she has created as part of her successful Kickstarter campaign, what her work as a creative technologist and senior program manager at the garage entailed, her passion for quantum computing, and how the worlds of high-tech fashion and quantum computing overlap in her life. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, sure, I dig it. You can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by yours truly. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review and 5 stars on that podcasting platform of your choice. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or heck you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's AMELIA, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of October 1st, 2021, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.